Are there any questions about material for the previous lecture before we go on with the new stuff? Hey, if anything comes up while we're doing the new stuff, just feel free to ask, even if it's about previous material. Okay, so the plan for today is to talk about symplectin manifold. So we're getting to the good stuff. We're actually going to see something that relates to physics, finally. So we're kind of building up to this. We're going to go back for the next lecture to something that's more technical, just to see how we do integration. But I thought it would be nicer to first do something that's more related to physics. So this is essentially the framework of Hamiltonian dynamics. So it's in terms of differential geometry, that's where Hamiltonian stuff lives. Before we define symplectin manifold, I want to talk about dynamics first. In general, when we talk about dynamics, in applications and in models of reality, we're really talking about differential equations. We have something, we want to know how it changes in time, and we set up our models in terms of differential equations. So first of all, we need to know how a differential equation looks like in terms of geometry and manifold. So we're going to start with a vector field X. If X is a vector field on a manifold M, then we're going to define integral curves of this vector field. So a curve, we already kind of seen what curves were last time. This time we're going to take them to be defined on an open set. It's going to be some interval, which is open in R, could potentially be the whole real line. So this is a curve. As usual, we assume everything to be nice and smooth. So this curve is going to be called an integral curve of the vector field X if the following things happens. The tangent vector to gamma at point gamma of t is x at point gamma of t. So x is a vector field. At each point, it associates a vector. And that vector at a given point on the curve is the tangent vector of the curve. This happens, we say that gamma is an integral curve. So we're essentially trying to figure out a curve by looking at its tangent vectors, which is the idea of a differential equation. If you want to actually write this in a more compact formula, we're going to need to define what the tangent vector to gamma at point gamma of t is. And I'm going to use this notation for it. Gamma dot of t, this is going to be the tangent vector at gamma of t. And what exactly this as an object? So this is going to be actually a vector in t gamma of t m, because it's tangent at that point. And we define it as the vector that acts in this way. So remember, we define vectors as derivations. So I just need to define the action of this on a function f. And I'm going to define it just to be the derivative with respect to t of f composed gamma evaluated at t. And I can do this because gamma goes from the real numbers to the manifold. F goes from the manifold to the real numbers, so this is a nice function from R to R, and we can take derivatives. Yes?
So if I'm trying to picture this in my head, and we have a manifold, and we have a vector field which has like different directions of vectors at every single point on the manifold, why is it true that if you have a curve on that manifold, that the vector at a point on that curve is necessarily tangent to the curve?
So this vector x is not true in general. This vector I defined here, it is true in general. This is the vector that's tangent. The reason why is that if you think in terms of charts, we have a manifold M, and we have this curve here. And then we map this using the chart. Actually, let's assume that this is U, and then we have a bigger thing, which is M. So if we're looking at things locally, then what happens is that the chart phi is going to map this to something which is phi of U, which now lives in Rn. And we're mapping the curve to a curve. And because of all the requirements of smoothness, if this thing is smooth in here, then it's smooth in there. In fact, the definition of this being smooth is it is smooth in there. So this is point gamma of t. This is going to be gamma at of t, which is just a coordinate representation. And the point, the vector here, is the push forward of the vector there. Because we can always think of this as a manifold. So we have tangent space at this point. We can map to a vector at this tangent space. So the reason why we say that this is tangent is that when we look at it in coordinates, it is tangent.
Here, this makes sense. But when you said the tangent vector to gamma at point gamma t is x of gamma, why is this true?
Oh, that's a great question. It's not always true. So if it is true, then gamma is an integral curve. So this is the condition that has to happen for this to be an integral curve.
Okay.
This is probably going to be easier to understand if we just think of, forget about differential geometry for a moment. If I give you a vector field in terms of little arrows in the plane, and I tell you that they look like this, and same thing, and they just have circles, and they're smaller and smaller. If I want to integrate a curve, giving you the vector field, you start at the point, and then you follow the lines, and you start tracing these, and you get the circle. You've probably seen things like this. That's exactly what we're doing. I'm giving you, at every point in the plane, a vector. It's a vector field that changes smoothly. And then I'm telling you, you start at one point, and you want the tangent vector to your curve to be that vector. And then you kind of start moving along those tangent lines, and you find the curve. So that's the idea. And of course, whether or not an integral curve exists is a question about whether there are solutions of a differential equation. So in more compact forms, now that we have this, we're asking that gamma dot of t equals x, gamma of t. And this is a differential equation. This is a first order ODE on a manifold. Which we're going to use to describe dynamics. In our case, if we're thinking of physics, t is likely actually going to be time. And gamma is actually the path of something physical. It could be a particle that's moving or something that's not a particle, but coordinates that describe something else. So that's the idea. So if I give you a vector field, you can use that to find the physical path of something. That's the idea of differential equations. We're using first-order equations because you want to do something like Hamiltonian dynamics, which is first-order, instead of something which is second-order. Now, let's see what happens in coordinates, because it's going to be clearer, I hope. So in coordinates, so we're going to have some open, some subset U where we have coordinates, and then just going to have x1 to xn. gamma dot of t is going to look like this. We have the derivative with respect to time of f composed with gamma at t, and we're assuming that the point gamma of t is in this part. Well, then this is the same as d over dt of f composed with phi to the minus 1 composed with phi composed with gamma, at least close enough to the point t, because I'm just putting in the identity in here. But now this is going to be, this is a function that goes from Rn to R. This one goes from R to Rn. I can use the chain rule. So this is just going to be df at over dxi, and then we're going to have evaluated at gamma at t, and then we have d gamma at I over dt evaluated at t. Sorry, this is acting on the function f. But this thing here is the action of the operator d over dxi at gamma of t acting on f. That's our basis of vectors. So this means that gamma dot t, seen as a vector, is just going to be d gamma at I over dt at point t times d over dxi at gamma of t. So this is the coordinate representation of the tangent vector, which makes sense because it's essentially the coordinates of the tangent vector in this picture. This thing has exactly these coordinates in terms of the standard basis in Rn. They are just the usual, the tangent vector to a curve, you just take the derivative of the components and that's going to be your vector. So we have these written components, and at the same time, x of gamma of t can be written in terms of these spaces. So it's going to be something like xi evaluated at gamma of t times d over dxi at gamma of t. Just because this is a basis for the tangent space. So this means that the differential equation becomes, if you equate the components, d gamma dot I over dt evaluated at point t is this. And now this looks more like a differential equation. So in coordinates, it is actually just a differential equation of first order. So you could solve it locally, or if you have a manifold which is only one chart, then you're just doing a regular differential equation. Otherwise, you're patching solutions. You're finding a solution in one subset, and then you're going to patch it with other solutions, and so on. Any questions on this? And think about it for a moment while I up the board here. Hey, if you don't have questions, then I have a question for you. So we've seen that if I give you a vector field, we can use that to define dynamics, essentially. If we interpret the gamma to be a physical part, then all I have to do is give you a vector field, and that tells you what the differential equation is. Yes, you have a question?
Say, like, do we need like some initial condition to make sure that our solution, like the vector, actually passes through the point?
Yes, that's a good point. I'm missing something. So this is the differential equation without an initial condition. So you're also going to need something. With the picture I drew before that I actually erased, I gave you a starting point, and then we use the field to build up the solution. Yes, I need to tell you also where we're starting from. otherwise the solution is not unique. That's a very good point. So the question I was going to ask is, if I give a vector field, that tells us what the dynamics is. How do I find out what the vector field is supposed to be? Who gives me the vector field that I give you? Do I just pick a random vector field? Yes?
Could you like cover the manifold with a grid of curves and then the tangents to all of those curves? Oh, would that be like the tangent space? No, I don't know.
Let me rephrase it. So the thing is, we're essentially saying that a vector fields give you dynamics. So if I somehow have a way to pick up a vector field for some special reason, then I can use that to define dynamics. But how do I choose the vector field? Yes? Can you repeat that?
Hamiltonian vector field.
Right, so Hamiltonian vector field. So what it means is that I need something to tell me what the vector field is. So if you think of Newton's law is a differential equation. And the thing that's telling me what the vector field is Newton. Newton is telling me there's a law, and the law tells you what the vector field is. If I know what the force is, then I know what the vector field is, which is actually the force. And in terms of Hamiltonian mechanics, I need something that tells me what dynamics is. What gives me the dynamics in Hamiltonian mechanics? What is the thing that I need to tell you, and then you can go on, find the equations, and solve, ideally solve them? Yes?
The kinetic and potential energy, generally. I mean, you could also find it from the Lagrangian, but...
Yes, so essentially that. So if you're working with a nice mechanical system, then yes, potential and kinetic energy. If it's not conservative, then that doesn't work. But in general, if you give me the Hamiltonian, then I can give you dynamics. So that's our plan. We're going to find an Hamiltonian function. That's you need to come up with it. That's the idea of the model. You come up with a function, then we're going to find the vector field attached to the function, and that gives us dynamics. So that's the plan. That's why we need symplectic manifolds. So let's go on to defining symplectic manifolds. So we're going to say that a pair M omega is a symplectic manifold. I'm not going to rewrite it again. If M is a manifold and omega is a closed non-degenerate two-form on M. So the whole reason why we need the differential forms is that a symplectic manifold has a two-form on it, so we needed to know what that meant. We wanted to have these two properties, closed and non-degenerate. Closed, we've seen, just means that d omega is zero. That's the closed condition. Does anyone remember what non-degenerate means? You should have seen something like this with metric tensors.
Does it have zero eigenvalues? If it was a matrix?
Yeah, so as a matrix, you can think of it. I'm going to give you, there are two different ways of defining it. One is coordinate free, the other one is coordinates. The non-degenerate, sorry?
It's not zero.
Yeah, so in coordinates, then the determinant of the matrix associated to the two-form has non-zero determinant. If you want to do something that's more coordinate-free, then you're asking that at each point, if M is a point on the manifold, so you're looking at a specific point, so this is now just a tensor. If this thing is zero for all vectors u in t m m, this implies that v is zero. This is the abstract way of defining non-degenerate. Or you are simply saying that if omega m is of the form omega ij evaluated at m dx I tensor dxj, which you can always do, because at a single point, you can always write this in terms of the basis. And these are actually going to have an m because you're working at a single point. Then the determinant of omega ij m, so that's the matrix that has these components, is non-zero. It's the same thing that you've seen for the metric tensor. The metric tensor has the same thing. It needs to be invertible. So these are the only conditions that we need. And we're going to say that omega, we're going to call it a symplectic form. So this is somewhat similar to the idea of a metric tensor. It's going to be a tensor of rank 2, a covariant tensor, is non-degenerate. The difference is that this one is anti-symmetric instead of being symmetric. And we have the extra condition that it is closed. We don't have anything like that for the metric. Yes?
Are the second and the third statement equivalent?
Yes, so these two things are equivalent. That's, I can't really see, but this was an or. So it's either that or that, they are the same thing. Or maybe they just do an equivalent sign.
Does tangent space include zero or not?
Yes, the tangent space includes zero because it's a vector space.
Okay.
Yes?
I don't quite understand the second line. How come when the two form is zero, or sorry, that the form, K form is zero, how come, and U is in the tangent space, how come that means V is zero?
So if you think in terms of just matrices, let's pretend that we're not working on a manifold, we're just working on a real vector space. So that's essentially saying that we have something like U transpose and some matrix, I'm going to call it omega, the big omega, so we don't get confused, times V equals zero for all U. So that's what we're saying in components.
Okay.
And the only thing this can happen for all possible U, as, so this thing being zero for all U implies the V is zero.
Okay.
If this thing is true, this is the same as determinant of omega is different than zero. One way is obvious. If the determinant of omega is different than zero, then the only way you're essentially doing a dot product of a vector with another vector, and then you're saying a vector dot product with anything else is always zero. The only way it can happen is if the vector is zero.
What if
yes?
for any u that is in the tangent space at point M, so that includes also zero. So if U is equal to zero, you don't need the V to be zero either.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, there should be every non-zero. You're right. You're right.
So it's not.
Good catch. You're correct. If U is not zero, then that's going to be zero regardless. And then that does not imply the V is zero. Although actually it doesn't matter, because what we're saying is that if this thing is zero for every u, then v must be zero. Then in particular, when zero, you plug it in here, you get zero regardless, but it doesn't matter. Because we're asking that this property holding for every u implies the v is zero. It's not for if it happens for one of them, then it should happen. It just it must happen for every possible vector u. So actually, no, there's nothing wrong with not including u different zero. You can exclude it, include it, it doesn't matter. But really, if that line creates confusion, just think of the determinant at each point is different than zero.
Okay.
it's the same thing, so it doesn't really matter. You can think of it that way. Symplectic manifolds have some restrictions, just coming from this definition. The first thing is that the dimension of M must be even. Symplectic manifolds can only exist if they have even dimension. The reason why is that this matrix is an antisymmetric matrix because the tensor is antisymmetric. And the determinant of an antisymmetric matrix, if gamma or, yes, let's just call capital omega is the matrix that has coordinates omega j. So gamma transpose is minus, sorry, omega transpose is minus omega. But this means that the determinant of omega transpose, which is the same as the determinant of omega, is minus 1 to the n determinant of omega. So you may get a minus sign, and then if you get a minus sign, the determinant must be 0. So the only time the determinant is allowed not to be 0 is if n is even. So the minus sign disappears. So symplectic manifolds must be two-dimensional. So there's that. So let's do this. That's the first thing. And the other restriction is actually on the way they look locally. So this thing here is called the Darboux theorem. And so it turns out that all of the manifolds that are symplectic kind of look the same. Yes?
Sorry, give me back.
That's okay. Questions are great. Feel free to stop me at any time.
So here, okay. Why two specifically? Can you say that one more time?
Why what specifically?
Oh, is it only that it must be even dimension?
It must be even. It doesn't have to be two.
It doesn't have to be two?
It just has to be an even number. So it can be 2, 4. I guess it can be 0, but then it becomes trivial.
And that's because we need n to be...
So this thing is... So we're going to have the matrix representation of the tensor. The components are going to form a matrix, an n by n matrix, which is antisymmetric. So if you call omega the matrix, omega transpose is minus omega. The determinant of omega transpose is the same as the determinant of omega. Mm-hmm. But because omega is minus... omega transpose is minus omega, it's going to be the same as minus 1 to the n determinant of omega.
So,
because multiplying a matrix by a number, pulls out, with the determinant, it pulls out the number to the power of the dimension of the matrix. So now we're asking that these two things are the same. So this implies if n is odd, this means that the determinant is 0. So a thing that happens is that antisymmetric matrices in odd dimensions are always at determinant 0. There's no way around it. So because we're asking that the determinant is non-zero, that only works in even dimensions.
How do you know that this is the only restriction, and where did you find it? Because it doesn't directly, at least in my mind, I can't directly get from the definition of a symplectic manifold to finding this restriction, but you calculated the determinant and you saw, we have a minus 1 to the n and therefore it has to be even.
Yes, it comes from here. I'm asking that, so I have an n-dimensional manifold, so n is the dimension of the manifold M. I'm asking that this works. So I'm saying that at each point, the matrix that represents the tensor has determinant different than 0. The tensor is a two-form, so it's antisymmetric. So this matrix is antisymmetric. It's an n by n antisymmetric matrix. If the dimension is odd, this matrix has a time in a zero.
Okay.
So this cannot happen, so it cannot be a simple experiment. Yes?
We saw, I think, in the first tutorial that like zero-dimensional manifolds are like collections of points, I guess?
Yes.
So does that mean like if n is zero for like a symplectic manifold, can we actually, like, is that actually a well?
Yeah, actually, thinking more about it, I don't think it makes sense in a zero-dimensional manifold.
Yeah.
Because then what even is a zero by zero matrix?
Yeah, you have no notion of two forms anyways, right?
Yes.
So what is that?
I didn't think too much about it. If it does exist, it's probably something extremely trivial. So it doesn't really matter.
Okay. But does that say anything about like discretizability of symplectic manifolds or something like that?
I don't know. I really didn't think about this. I don't want to say just throw something out there that may be wrong. So let's. If you're still interested, just ask me at some other point. We can think about it more. Because I'll probably just say something and then it turns out to be false. So not say anything. Yes?
The main reason we're looking at two forms because we want to apply it to Hamiltonian dynamics with P and Q?
So the reason why we're looking at two form, I don't know if there's a reason, like right now it's not evident why do we look at two form. Just if we use a two form, then we end up with something that turns out to be very nice and it describes what we want. So I kind of have a justification of, let's define this, then we're going to find something that is Hamilton's equations, therefore there was the correct way of doing it. I don't have a way of saying that this must be an anti-symmetric thing for a special reason. I don't know. Maybe there is, but I don't know if there is one.
It also gives you a Poisson bracket.
Can you repeat that?
It also gives you the Poisson bracket. That's one of the reasons.
Yes, right. We want to do a Poisson bracket. So the Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric. So that kind of suggests things. But again, that comes going back because I'll define the Poisson bracket in terms of omega. And it's anti-symmetric because omega is anti-symmetric. But who said that I needed omega to define Poisson brackets? No one. So yes, being anti-symmetric gives us all the things that we want. But I don't have a reason starting out why it should be like that. It just turns out to work exactly the way we want it. So the second restriction is Darboux's theorem that tells us that if a manifold is symplectic, then, at each point, M in the manifold, there is a local chart U. Then I'm going to have, so because the manifold must have even dimension, is going to be something like 2n. So I'm going to have coordinates of the form q1, q2, all the way to qn. And I'm going to split them up into a set of two. And then we have p1, p2, pn, such that omega restricted to u is this form. So what this theorem tells you is that you can always locally write omega in this shape, which, as we'll see in a moment when we do the first example of this, is kind of like the standard way of doing a symplectic form. If we were looking at flat space with a symplectic form, that's the simplest thing. So this is the equivalent of the flat metric. This is a lot stronger than what happens with a Riemannian manifold. Or pseudo-Riemannian manifold. If I give you a pseudo-Riemannian manifold, at each point you can always diagonalize the metric, but it's not true that you can always locally diagonalize the metric. I cannot say that any manifold, if I look at a region that's small enough, in that region the metric looks flat in the whole region. Instead, if I have a symplectic manifold, I can always find at each point a local region around it where it looks like this.
Is that point M, omega M?
So this is just restricted to the whole set U. So that's what I meant. For a Riemannian manifold, at each point, you can always do this. You can always diagonalize the metric and just make it the standard flat metric, but only at a point in general. Otherwise, you have a locally flat Riemannian manifold. But in this case, at each point, I can find a little region around it, and in the whole region, it looks like this. So this comes from the requirement that we have a two form rather than just any tensor, and also the closed condition. Yes, what's that?
We are contracting the indices, so are we assuming some background metric on this manifold?
Good question. No, there is no background metric. So I'm contracting the indices just by doing a sum, and that's actually a good question because it brings us to the placement of the indices. Usually, what people do in this kind of stuff is put the indices of the Qs up and the indices of the P down. It's just a convention. But the reason why we do this is that then we can write stuff like this and it still works using Einstein's convention of summing higher indices and lower indices. And also, there's the idea, as we'll see, that the PI are actually kind of components that mean covectors and the QIs kind of mean vectors. So they are, in a sense, these things are covariant. But we'll see that when we see the examples. So that should be clearer when we see actually the examples. I hope so. So if that's not clear by the time we do the cotangent bundle example, ask me again. Yes?
Here, how do you differentiate between Qs and Ps? Because the numbers, the upstairs and downstairs is arbitrary, you said, it's just a convention.
Yes.
But why do you have only wedge product between one Q and one P? Why not two Qs or two Ps?
So that's the thing. Maybe I should have done this later. So I'm going to show you examples. We're going to, hopefully this makes more sense once we see the examples. It's just the simplest way you can come up with an anti-symmetric matrix is going to be something that looks like the matrix that appears in this tensor. So hopefully it's going to be clear in a bit. So again, I'm going to show you examples. At the end of the examples, if things are still not clear, then ask me the same question again. Yes?
Does this mean that the symplectic structure, like that every symplectic manifold is locally the same?
Yes. So that's what the point I was about to make. The other restriction is, because of this, locally, every symplectic manifold looks the same because they all look like this. So you can always give coordinates to a symplectic manifold that are at least in a neighborhood of each point look like this one, and that's going to be true for any of them. So they are locally the same. So this is not at all what happens for Riemannian manifolds, luckily, otherwise it would mean that everything is locally flat and then everything is boring. So this means that if two symplectic manifolds are different, then the difference is not something that you can notice locally. It's a global property of the whole manifold. So it could be one of them as a whole, the other one doesn't, that kind of stuff, but not something that you can notice just locally. Instead, if you have a Riemannian manifold, you may have two of them, you can look at the curvature locally and it tells you something. If two manifolds have different curvature locally, they're different. While if I give you two symplectic manifolds and I just know how to do them locally, you cannot find any difference between them. So that's a big restriction that symplectic forms have. Okay, so, yes?
So, what I wanted to ask is, in Riemannian geometry, we can write the Riemann tensor as derivatives of the metric. Is it a similar quantity that we can do here, or because of what you said now, it wouldn't make sense because it's flat?
Yeah, it's the same thing. Like if you build something, so the thing that you usually build out of this, we're not really going to use it, but you can build something out of this thing, and it's going to be just like you do a volume form out of the metric, you can build a volume form out of the symplectic form. So that's the thing they usually build up. But again, locally they all look the same. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to try to differentiate things. So you usually build the curvature thing just because it helps you differentiate the various manifolds. It tells you something important. But for this kind of manifolds, locally everything looks the same. So if you want to look at differences, then you need to look at topological stuff, really. Yes?
It also looks like the symplectic form is, I guess, locally exact as well, right?
Yes. Yeah, so it's going to be locally exact. That's a good point. It's locally exact because locally, if I take the D of this thing, because these already have Ds in the DQI and DPI, I use the formula where I can distribute over the wedge product, and I'm going to get zero. So that's a good point. It's always going to be locally exact. Although that's always true that a closed form is always locally exact. So while this is true, it doesn't come from being a symplectic manifold. It just comes from the fact that it's a closed form. We talked about last time closed forms versus exact forms. So globally, again, and that's the topological property, globally, it really depends on the space whether a closed form is exact. But locally, it's always going to be true for a manifold. Because locally, you're always going to be in a patch where you can write that as some function times di, and it just going to work out. Yes?
I know, like, in Riemannian manifold, we can define curvature as, like, R, scalar R, but, like, how we can define curvature here in symplectic?
So you don't really define a curvature here.
Yeah, because, you know, you were mentioning that, you know, in Riemannian manifold, we can just say, okay, locally, we can find something that's different, right? Like R, for instance, right? But, like, you mentioned that we cannot find anything locally that is not consistent with, like, different symplectic manifolds.
Yes, so they would all look the same. So even if you define some kind of tensor that only depends on omega, then if you look at it locally, it's always going to be the same in all symplectic manifolds. So it doesn't give you any useful information. That's what I was trying to say.
Okay.
If you're trying to differentiate things.
This is a statement in my mind, just correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just saying, like, not every Riemannian manifold is a symplectic manifold, but all symplectic manifolds can be Riemannian manifold, but like defining...
So they're actually two completely separate things. So symplectic manifolds are one thing, Riemannian manifolds are another thing.
I define metric and like tensor R and everything on top of symplectic manifold.
You can do that. So they become a different kind of thing. And so you could define them separate. Then there are some compatibility conditions. So you can actually put together a metric and a symplectic form. And that happens if you have complex manifolds. Then you can build this in some kind of manifolds we call color manifolds. So there are a lot of things you can do if you're trying to put them together. It's not something we're interested in at the moment, so I'm not going to spend time on it. If you have questions about it, just feel free to ask outside of class. I can give you references, I can tell you about it. Just there's a lot of stuff to tell you today and not a lot of time. You have a question? Oh, okay, sorry. Looks like you had your hand up. Okay, so let's go on to the examples. And hopefully it's going to make a few things clearer. Okay, so the first example is the simplest thing we can do. We're going to use R2N as a manifold. And the form is going to be just omega, which is of this form. We're going to have omega AB DXA tensor DXB. And this omega, which is the matrix that has those components, is just going to be this one. So this is called the standard symplectic form on R2N. It's the simplest thing we can do. We just have identities in it. We have zeros here. It's a block matrix. So this is the zero matrix n by n. Then we have identity minus identity zero. It's trivially antisymmetric. And the determinant of this thing is actually going to be omega should be, I think, minus 1 to the n. If I did think correctly, yes. So it satisfies everything it needs to satisfy. This thing is constant. They are just numbers, which means that d omega is going to be omega AB d squared xA. Well, you need to write it in terms of a form, but you can see that this is zero. It's going to be clearer why once I actually write coordinates in that shape before. So let's try to write coordinates in the shape that we have right there. with the Darboux coordinates. To do this, I'm going to change coordinates, and I'm going to replace x1 to xn, x2n. I'm just going to rename them to q1, qn, the first n of them, and then p1 to pn. Yes?
Is determinant of omega minus 1 to the n or n plus 1?
So the it's minus 1 to the n, because for the block matrix of this form,
because n is equal to 1, you have 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and the determinant of that is plus 1.
So if I did my calculations correctly when I prepared the lectures, the determinant of this matrix is going to be the determinant of this times this as a matrix. So the determinant of 0, and then it's going to be minus the determinant of this. So you're right, it's always going to be 1.
I thought it was probably n plus 1.
This should be always 1, because it's going to be minus the determinant of this times this, which is the identity, plus the identity. So it's the determinant of the identity. I forgot the minus sign. It doesn't matter. The important thing is that it's non-zero, but it's actually always 1. But thank you for noticing something was wrong. So what I'm doing here is not really changing variables, but just renaming them. So I have 2n variables. I call the first ones q, the first set of n, and the second set are just p1 to pn. And the reason why I'm doing this is that now omega, because it's anti-symmetric, omega is going to be the sum from a equals 1 to n. And also, if you look at the way the matrix works, the first row, I'm skipping the first 10 things altogether, and I'm just jumping to the next thing. So I'm going to do the sum from a equals 1 to n, and then the sum from b that goes from n plus 1 to 2n, and I have dxa times dxb. So that's what happens when I just look at this part of the matrix. I have each row. I'm summing over the rows with the index a, and then I'm only summing over the columns that are after the first half. So b starts from n plus 1. And then for the other ones, I'm doing minus because of the minus identity. And then this time I have the rows that start from n plus 1. So a goes from n plus 1 when, and b, which is the columns, goes from 1, sorry, this is to n, 1 to n, and then I have dx, a tensor dxb. So this is the same as this. I'm just skipping this altogether and just doing sums explicitly without having any kind of Einstein summation. Yes?
We need a equals b plus n or b equals a plus n for it to be the identity.
Right, we probably need some delta somewhere. That's a good point. So we need delta AB in addition to this. Thanks. So we have delta ABs appearing inside as well. That's just identity matrix. Okay, so this is going to be the same as the sum from a equals 1 when, sum from b equals n plus 1 to 2n. And this thing is the same as this one. If I just swap the indices, they are dummy indices, so it doesn't matter. And I have a minus sign. So this is essentially going to be dxa tensor xb minus dxb tensor dxa with the delta ab in front of it.
Can you explain delta ab again in the first line?
Yes. So this matrix here is the identity matrix. So that means that when I'm summing over the rows, I'm going to get a zero if I have actually yeah, this is uglier than I thought. It's not going to be delta AB. It's going to be delta A is probably going to be B minus N. And then we have A minus N B. I think that's the correct way of doing it. It's kind of ugly. I'm hoping this will be easier.
Why do you need the deltas?
You need the deltas to make sure that these indices match. Right, on the first row, in the simplest case, 2 by 2, I have an identity matrix. So I have something like 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1. So I should get 1 if I have the first row and the third column, but 0 if I have the first row and the fourth column. And then there's other stuff down here. So this is now going to be dA, B, minus N. So this is, again, the same sums. So I'm just going to skip what it says on the sums. But this is just the wedge product dXA wedge dXB. And then I have a delta AB minus N. And this thing here is the same in terms of the other coordinates as dqi wedge dpi. So it simplifies considerably if you use the other coordinates. The steps are actually a lot more annoying than I thought because I forgot the deltas and then it seemed like everything was easy. So if you don't trust the steps, and you probably shouldn't, you can just try to do this yourself. Because we really don't have time to spend too much on it. But the point of this is that the omega form can actually be written in the shape of the Darboux theorem. And this is globally because now these coordinates work everywhere. So the Darboux theorem tells you that every symplectic manifold locally looks like the standard symplectic manifold, which is this one, R to N with this symplectic form. And now that you have it in this form, the fact that d omega is 0 is obvious because if you act with the exterior derivative on this, you get 0. Just because of the properties of d squared being 0 and the distribution over the wedge product. So that's the simplest thing you can do. Not the most interesting. The most interesting one for physics purposes is the next example. Yes?
Is there also a construction theorem if I think about it as phase space and then something that tells me which coordinates I should choose such that I can achieve this?
So as far as I know, this is not constructive. So it just tells you that there is such a way of doing it. It doesn't tell you how to do it.
Some other theorem that will tell me which canonical coordinates I can choose.
So the idea with this thing is it just tells you that you can find some coordinates in which this works. Then those coordinates, you can swap them around using some canonical transformations, and you're going to end up with the same thing. So there is not a canonical way of choosing them. So when we're doing things like this, we are making a very arbitrary choice. I started with this matrix, but I could have chosen any matrix that looks like this, any matrix that's similar to that. Or, yeah, so it still would have worked. I could have used any anti-symmetric matrix that gives me something close. There are other ways of doing this that is not specifically that one. So those coordinates are nice. If I change coordinates, it's not going to look like that anymore. So I don't know if there's a way to actually construct it. There is in the example that we're going to do because there is a natural way of doing things. So in some cases, right now here, I had to make an arbitrary choice. In what I'm about to show you, the choice is not arbitrary. There is a natural way of doing it, which is usually nice. We like natural constructions. The next example is the cotangent bundle of a manifold. So I have any manifold M, and I build the cotangent bundle of it. Now, the cotangent bundle has dimension, which is twice the dimension of M. So this means that the cotangent bundle is always two-dimensional. So it's a very good candidate for what we're about to do. It does not have the problem of maybe it doesn't work. It's always going to be even dimensional. So that part works. Now, on the cotangent bundle, there is a natural one form, which is called the canonical one form. That we're going to call theta. It's also called the tautological one form. And it's already in there. It's a natural construction. You don't need any external information to build it. To build it up, I'm going to use coordinates just to make things simpler. So in coordinates, if Q1 to Qn are coordinates on the manifold M, we've seen how to give coordinates to the tangent bundle, the cotangent bundle. We're going to do Q1 to Qn, P1 to Pn are coordinates on T star M. And these P1 to Pn are not chosen randomly. If you remember the way we chose them, they are functions that associate to points in T star M or the form M, and then you have something in the cotangent space. So it's going to be something like this, alpha j dx or dq because of annotation dq m j. So here I have a point in the cotangent bundle. It's going to be the point at which I'm based and something which lives in the cotangent space at that point. So just a covector. So this lives in Tm star m. But I have a coordinate basis of that space. So I just use the dqjm. So any covector can be written as a linear combination of these spaces. And these functions are defined by just spitting out alpha j. So they give you the components in terms of the coordinate dual basis. So it's a natural thing to do. If I have coordinates on M, those induce a basis on the cotangent space, and I can use these maps to figure out the components in that basis. I don't know who was first. All right?
So what's the first argument of PY?
It's just a point M in the manifold. So this is something that lives in M. Yes?
Alpha I on the right-hand side, right?
Yes, it should be alpha I. Yeah, so I have PI. This picks up all these components, the I one. Okay, so this is just a review because this was in the lectures, the recorded ones, and in the lecture notes. So now that we have these things, we can build up this form in this way, at least locally. So restricted to some subset U, which has coordinates. This is just going to be defined as PI DQI. This is a natural construction because all we used are things that are already in here. Now, I'm not going to show you this because we don't have time and I want to get to the good stuff. So I'll probably just ask you to prove this yourself in the tutorial. But it turns out that this does not depend on coordinates. Yes?
I have a question about the definition of the p's.
Yes.
The p's are covectors. Shouldn't they act on vectors?
The p's are not covectors. These things here are charts, are components of a chart. So this means that PI is a function that goes from some subset of P star M. And they map to R. They don't actually act on vectors. They are not covectors, these things here. They are things that take as input a point in the manifold and a covector, and they give you the components of the covector in terms of the basis. It gives you the ith component. Yes?
Isn't this one form just a covector in T star Qm?
Sorry, this form is a covector in
T star Qm, like at point Q in the manifold.
Great question. It is not. So when I say that this is a one form, this is actually one form. This lives in the one forms on T star M. So this is a bit of a source of confusion because T star M contains one forms. But now we're doing the set of one forms on T star M. So we have kind of one forms of one forms. So it's a double star that we're doing. We're doing the double tangent bundle in a sense. So that's a good point. So when we're thinking of it this way, then this DQI is not a one form. When I write it here, this is not actually one form on M anymore. This is seen as a one form on T star M. Because T star M has coordinates Q1 all the way to Qn, P1 to Pn. So that's a very good point and something to keep an eye out for because it's a bit confusing. Yes?
So if I have some Hamiltonian, some phase space function which depends on these coordinates, and I assume I can invert the momenta for the velocities, then I could also go back to Lagrangian mechanics?
Yes, you cannot always do that though.
But assume if I would be able to do this, then the tangent bundle on which the Lagrangian is defined would also be a symplectic manifold?
Yes.
Can I then also find a natural one form in
space? You cannot. So that's a great question. So you're asking, so it's a bit going ahead of what we're supposed to do, but if this is the space where Hamiltonian mechanics works, and you invert these things, you go back from momenta to velocities, then what you're doing is instead of T star M, you're working with Tm, you're working with the tangent bundle, because you can think of that as points and tangent vectors, so points and velocities. So does that mean that we can give a two form that's closed, that's why it's a symplectic form, to the tangent bundle? And we can, but not in a natural way, which is why we like this. So for the cotangent bundle, the one form is natural. It just comes out with the structure. If I want to get a one form on the tangent bundle, I need to start from the one form that we're defining here. Then I need to pull it back to the other bundle. And to pull it back, I need a Lagrangian. So I need to use the Lagrange transform to go back from one to the place. So I need extra stuff. And if the Lagrangian is not regular or hyperregular, then it doesn't work. So you cannot always do that. It's the same idea as vector space and its dual. If you want to go from one to the other in a natural way, you need something more. If I don't give you anything else, then you will need to make an arbitrary choice. And arbitrary choices are not good in physics, because Wu said that was the right choice. So we would like to really have something natural. And something natural either means it's already there, or you need to add stuff on top of it with a reason. Yes?
This is the DQIs here are not a part of the cotangent bundle of Q?
Because we are imagining them as something different. So here, DQI is something that goes from T star M to T star of T star M. Or at least to a subset of this. Because they are not one forms on M, they are one forms on T star M.
Okay.
It just happens that they have the same name because the Q, we use them as the same notation for the coordinates on M and the coordinates on T star M. So that creates confusion. So it's something to keep an eye out for.
The quantity that you defined here, theta, is in omega. I don't don't understand the notation there. Omega 1 T star M?
Yeah, so this is the notation we add for the set of one forms.
Oh,
okay. So this is set of all the one forms on T star M. So yes, the same idea. It's that means that it's the functions that go from here to here, and then the projection should be the identity.
And here, when you define your omega for this example, I understand the first n rows, but for the second n rows, you have minus one. And for the first n rows, you're basically saying this omega is acting like it eats a q and it gives you out a p because
yes
it, yeah and but if it, and it also if it eats a p it gives you out a q
yes
the minus because yeah
yeah so remember that this is the same as dqi tensor dpi minus dpi tensor dqi
but why do you want it to if it eats p why do give us back q?
It's not that we want it, this is the simplest way of doing this. And we're going to see that's what happens in here. So technically, this is the more interesting example. So we'll see that with this thing right here, which is, as I said, the natural one form that you can add on this space, then omega is going to look exactly like that. Mm-hmm. And if we use that omega, we do Hamiltonian mechanics with lots of cool stuff. And then because that's cool, then we just do the same thing on R2. So when we're saying this is the standard structure on R2, it just means that if you have flat space and you want to do Hamiltonian mechanics, instead of using differential geometry, you just use R2 and you define a form that's global and everything works. Or if you want, these examples are exactly the same once you use this fact. T star Rn is isomorphic to R2n as manifolds. So what we're doing here is this structure that we put here, we are borrowing it from T star Rn. So they are really the same example, in a sense. OK, so I was about to tell you something about this. So this does not depend on coordinates. What I mean is that if I change coordinates qi to another set of coordinates, so if qi goes to, or qi goes to q tilde I, and then, sorry about my q's looking like p's, that's very confusing. And then the pi are going to go to p tilde I, and note that this actually is induced by the change in q. So these ones, I can just change them whichever way I want. I change coordinates. These coordinates cannot change in any possible way, because remember, they were induced by the coordinate basis. So that means I will define something like p tilde I of m alpha j dq tilde j m. This should still give me alpha j. So these are defined in the same way as before. Then it turns out that theta in these new coordinates looks like p tilde I dq tilde I. So it doesn't matter which coordinates I choose, it looks exactly the same. And in that way, it's natural. It was not an arbitrary choice. Because the way I wrote it like this is just, I have coordinates, I make it up this way. But if you change coordinates and it looks different, then it's arbitrary, and that's not good. But if you change coordinates, you get exactly the same shape. And so it is a natural construction. If you want to, you can do this even without coordinates, but that takes more time. And we don't have time. As usual, anytime something is in coordinates, if you are the kind of person who likes coordinate-free stuff, then feel free to come and ask me. I also like coordinate-free stuff, so I can tell you how things are done or give you references. OK, so we have this one form. And how do we go from a one form to a two form, which is what we're looking for?
exterior derivative.
Exterior derivative.
Yes, we're going to take the exterior derivative. So we're going to define omega to be minus d theta. The minus is for convention. And how does it work? So we have something of the form pi. So we're doing d of pi dqi. Now, pi is a zero form because it's just a function. It's a function that goes from the tangent bundle to the real numbers. This is a one form. And you can take the wedge product of a one zero form and a one form, but it turns out to be just a product. So this is the same as d of pi wedge dqi. Just usually we don't write the wedge because it's trivial. And this means that this is going to be d pi wedge dqi minus, actually without the minus because this is a zero form. So remember that that anti-symmetric property only happens if the degree of the first thing is odd. The degree of this is zero, so we get a plus. Not that it matters, because we get pi wedge d squared of qi, but this is zero, because d squared is zero. And there was a minus in front of everything that I forgot. So the minus, I can just use it to swap these things around, and I get dqi wedge dpi. Yes?
But the pi's are functions of the qi's, right?
The pi's are functions of, that's a good question. So pi is a function that takes a point in the manifold and a covector. So it's something that takes this, which is in t star m, and maps to it a real number. So they are not really called, they don't depend on the q's, they depend on the points. Now, the points are, we can think of them as positions. And these, we're going to think of them as momenta. Because they are vectors, and I mean, why are momenta covectors? Simply because if we do this structure, it's natural, and it gives you Hamiltonian mechanics. So the p's depend on a point in the tangent bundle. So do the q's. The qi's are also functions that go from here to here. It's just that the p's only care about this part, and the q's only care about this part. The q's don't care about the covector that's in here. The p's don't care about the point. So this means that the p's are the components of the covector, or momentum. And the q's are the coordinates of the point, so they are the positions. So this is a bit different than what you usually see, because when we're working in Rn, you can conflate the coordinates and the points. You have the point xy, which lives in R2, for example, and xy are both points in R2, but also the coordinates of those points. So you can think of them as points or functions. It's very confusing. So to avoid confusion, I'm just using different letters. So the point is m, the momentum is alpha, and the coordinates are p and q.
So the difference is that even though the q's are charts on coordinates on t star m, they don't necessarily have to be the coordinates of on the manifold itself.
They are also the coordinates on the manifold.
But if that was the case, then the p would depend on the q's, and dpi would be something like.
Well, it just, the way we defined the p's is this. And the way we define the q's is that if I give it this pair, they actually don't care about the second thing, and they just give me the coordinate of this on the manifold. So it's just the way we defined the chart. If we have a manifold and we do the tangent bundle, the way we define coordinates on the tangent bundle is by borrowing the charts for the points from the manifold, and we build up the charts for the covectors by defining them like this. It's just the easiest thing we can do to make it up. And then you can go and change coordinates, and you mix up the q's and the p's, and then then you may end up in a situation where the Qs depend on the Ps or on the momenta, and the Ps depend on the position. You can do that. It's not very useful because then it messes up the whole thing. So we usually don't like to do that. Okay, so now we're going to see more fun stuff. So we actually have not a lot of time to do all the stuff I wanted to do. So we're going to have to continue next week. Well, no, we'll see each other tomorrow. We'll just probably do this tomorrow. We may not have time to do integration. So we'll see. Kevin may have to talk to you about that when needed. Okay, so at this point, we're going to talk about Hamiltonians and Hamiltonian vector fields. By the way, thank you for all the questions. It's great. It's messing up my schedule completely, but it's beautiful. Please keep doing that and mess up my schedule. OK, so if we have a symplectic form omega, we use it to associate to a function f that goes from the manifold to R a vector field. We're going to call it xf to remember that it comes from the function f. And this goes from the manifold to M. So remember the question that I asked at the beginning, how do we find the vector field? We use a symplectic form. I give you a function, and we build up the vector field. And the function is going to be the Hamiltonian function. So once I give you the Hamiltonian, that's going to build up a vector field. And then you integrate the vector field to find physical paths. So that's the plan. So this thing here is called the Hamiltonian vector field. Field associated to F. So every function is going to define an Hamiltonian vector field. So how do we do this? It's quite simple. We're just going to say that omega of xf dot is going to be df. Now we are thinking of this thing here. So we're think of it as a one form in the sense that, so I'm feeding a vector field to the first entry, and then this thing here, I can think of it as a map that takes another vector field as input. So it's kind of a standard construction to do things like this. So if you think of this as a one form, we can equate it to another one form. And the one form is going to be the only one form we can build out of F, and that's df. So we are equating two one forms. So this is a standard thing. And in fact, just as an aside, you can do the exact same thing if you have a metric tensor. So if G is a metric tensor, we can do this. We say gx dot equals df. This defines x as the gradient of f. So this is actually quite common. And this works because omega is non-degenerate. So the fact that it's non-degenerate means that you can use it essentially to lower and raise indices. That's what's happening here. So this is taking a vector, make it into a covector. So it's lowering indices, just as G does. This is just a coordinate-free way of saying that. So we can do this and construct a vector field. Let me show you what it looks like in coordinates, which is going to be hopefully more enlightening. Okay, so in coordinates, we're going to have df equals df over dxi. And actually, because we're using q and p, let's do this. We're going to have over dqi dqi plus df at over dpi dpi. I'm assuming that I'm using the coordinates coming from the Darboux theorem. So I can always have coordinates where I have the qi pi, which means that omega locally looks like dqi wedge dpi. The vector field xf is going to look something like this. We can write it in terms of the frames associated to the coordinates q and p. So it's going to look like something that has a I d over dqi plus b I d over dpi. A and b are unknowns. We need to figure out what they are. It's just that any vector field locally looks like this. And finally, well, actually, no, that's it. All the steps we need are here. So what is omega of xf dot? So we're taking omega, we're feeding as the first entry this tensor field. So remember that this is dqi tensor dpi minus dpi tensor dqi. So the first entry is this minus this. So we're going to feed this inside this one form. So dqi, when it acts on d over dqi, or maybe let's use different letters. Let's do j for this one. So when you have dqi acting on d over dqj, you get the delta ij, because they're dual to each other. So this means that this pulls out the aj out of here times a delta, so it really is going to be ai, and then it just multiplies dpi. And then when it acts on the second part, it gives you zero because the q's and the p's are different coordinates, so the deltas just cancel out. And then the second thing gives us a minus. This acts only on the second component. The first one gives us zero, so it pulls out the b out of this. So this is the one form that we get by acting with omega on xf. And really, what we did was just lowering and raising indices. And then we equate this to df. So we equate the dpi part and the dpi part. So that tells us that ai should be df over dpi. And then bi should be df minus df over dqi because of the minus sign. So eventually, xf is going to look like this. Df at over dpi d over dqi. Notice how we still are aligning the i's so that the sum works out nicely. Minus df at over dqi I d over dpi. So in coordinates, this is the Hamiltonian vector field associated to f. Actually, this thing is a good instructive point. If you're doing something that has to do with symplectic manifolds and you use the convention that the indices are up for the Qs, down for the Ps, which not everyone uses. But if you do, at any point, you have a formula in which the sum doesn't work, in the sense that they're not up and down as they should be, you probably did something wrong. So you can go and double check to make sure that things are correct. OK, so a Hamiltonian vector field associated to a function means that, so we'll just get to actually Hamilton's equations, and then we don't have time and we have to do the rest of the stuff tomorrow. So let's go back to the idea of integral curves. So we're going to select a special function. The Hamiltonian which is a function that goes from M to R. So just some function that you decide based on some assumptions. And how you figure out what it is, that's completely up to you. In mechanics, you usually say if it's a conservative field, then you get kinetic energy, and you add the potential energy. You say, let's hope this is right. Then you get the equations of motions, they match reality, and you're happy. Otherwise, you need to come up with something, see what the equations are. If they match reality, that's good. If they don't match reality, try another Hamiltonian. So we associate to it XH, which is the Hamiltonian vector field associated to the Hamiltonian. It's a bit weird because it has Hamiltonian twice in the name, but that's what it is. And so we're going to say that the physical path is an integral curve of XH. So that's how we find out what the vector field is, by specifying an Hamiltonian. And so this means that our differential equation that models dynamics is gamma dot of t equals XH evaluated at point gamma of t. So this is our Hamilton's equation. Written in the differential geometric way. Now, this looks nothing like Hamilton's equation, but it's going to do it just in time for finishing at 0:30. We just need to go back to coordinates.
Yeah.
Any questions? Yes?
Why is the partial of qi acting on the second part of the wedge product zero?
Sorry, where?
The partial of qi in xf, when it acts on the second part, dpi tensor dqi, that is zero.
So it is this that acts on the partials, because we are feeding this inside this. So dqi of, maybe I should have written this. So dqi of d over dqj is delta ij, but dqi of d over dpj is zero. And same thing if you swap p and q's. So that's where that comes from. OK, so if the Hamiltonian function is h, this means that xh equals dh at over dpi, d over dqi, minus dh at over dqi, d over dpi. So this is our vector field. And gamma dot of t, as we've seen at the beginning of the lecture, looks like this. We're going to have d gamma at I. Actually, this is where we're going to need a better notation. So I'm going to say that gamma at of t, I'm going to give it this coordinate representation. I'm going to call it q1 of t all the way to qn of t, p1 of t, to Pn of t. So I'm doing a bit of an abuse of notation because I'm reusing the name of the coordinates, but I'm making them components of a curve. But people usually do this, so we're going to do it as well. So this means that we can write this as dqi over dt evaluated at t d over dqi plus dpi over dt at t d over dpi. Now, when you equate these two things, equate the things that have the dqi and the things that have the d over dpi, and this gives you the equations q dot I equals dh over dpi, and p dot I is minus dh over dqi. And these are the Hamilton's equations that you all know and love. So as you can see, indeed, these equations are the same as these ones. So that's why we call them Hamilton's equations. So the whole point here is that if you have a symplectic form, you can use it to construct the vector field, which gives you Hamilton's equations once you specify an Hamiltonian function. There's a lot more stuff that you can do using symplectic manifolds. We're going to see that tomorrow, just because we're out of time. So we're going to see about Poisson structures. So we're going to see Poisson brackets, and then we're going to talk about symmetries and Noether's theorem. And at this point, probably we're not going to talk much about integration. So I'll let you know then if you're going to see it at all, if Kalman is going to talk about it, and we'll figure it out. OK, so that's it for the lecture. If you have any questions, feel free to ask. Otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow. Yes?
Do we know anything about the domain of that integral curve?
So the domain of the integral curve, in general, we assume that the integral curve is the, that's a good question. So you need to start using, if you want to figure out the solution, you need to use the various existence and uniqueness theorems for differential equations. So because the Hamiltonian is a smooth function, that satisfies a lot of nice properties for all these theorems. So at the very least, you're going to have local solutions that are unique. I'm not entirely sure about whether you can extend global resolution always. That may depend on Hamiltonian.
Would that be related with the system being integrable or something like that?
Yes.
Or symmetries of the system?
Yeah, so it's going to be connected to the kind of stuff. So I don't remember all the details, because usually we hear more about constructing the equations and actually solving them, because usually we cannot solve them. They are too complicated. But yeah, at least locally, you can always find a solution. Whether you can extend that solution globally, that's a different question. But that has to do with the domain of time more than anything else. So what you're saying is, can I find a solution that works for all times? Or is there a time at which everything breaks? And that depends on the system. Maybe at some point, if you let time go all the way to some point, you're going to blow up something. So you're going to have a domain that's closed. It doesn't go all the way from minus infinity to infinity. So that's really dependent on the actual function you have. So I don't know for sure if there's a way to always have it. You can always have a maximal solution. So there is a maximal solution, because you can use the various theorems about that. So you can extend it as much as it can go, and it's going to be unique. And then it may have to stop at some finite time, because otherwise things blow up. Yes?
I can now apply xa on the right hand side, because the Poisson bracket of h. So in this sense, probably it is that the Poisson bracket generates a continual chain.
Yes, we're going to see that. Yeah, so as it turns out, we're going to see this next lecture, but xf is the same as this. So the Poisson bracket also generates the Hamiltonian vector field. So that's what's happening. So for any function, the Hamiltonian vector field is exactly this. So again, you are keeping one of the things free. Now you think of it as a derivation. And it is a vector field. So you can use the Poisson brackets or the symplectic structure. In fact, they are the inverse of each other.